to Paper Town. A big company came in and shut one of them down. Seems like now all we get is one point of view. Hey, it don't really matter which side you're on. Nobody wins when our choices are gone. Both sides of a story often lead to the truth. Hey, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe it's no big deal. It's just my opinion. It's just how I feel. I dream of a world that's not all the same, where freedom is more than a word that we say, where you can say what you think and no one would dare put you down. I dream of a world that's a two-paper tent. I used to eat lunch at this small sandwich shop. Now there's a neon chain across that parking lot. They said we could have it our way, and that's what we did. There's a superstore out by the interstate. You get your shirts and your tires and your eggs in one place. I guess it's convenient. It is what it is. Hey, we save a few dollars, but what is the cost? If they don't know your name, seems like something is lost. I dream of not all the same, where a man with a vision can still find a way, where the little guy says to the big boys, you can't shut me down. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town, a two-paper town, yeah. Somewhere as me. Funny, we're further than ever from mankind living in peace. I dream of a world where, though we're not all the same, freedom is more than a word that we say, where you can say what you think and no one would dare put you down. I dream of the world. I dream of the world. That's a two-paper town. A two-paper town. A two-paper town.
And hello, universe. This is Matt Kramer talking to you live from Ordinary Miracles. And my partner, Jan Sircone, is still in Egypt, still probably having too much fun discovering, you know, ancient sources of magic and power. For those of you that are listening for the first time, this is a show about sound and healing. Jan does something called voice bio. I do something called voice mapping. And so let me get into our little two-minute commercial here. In voice bio, by the way, to get to know Jan's work, visit her website, musicforjoyandhealing.com, just like it sounds, musicforjoyandhealing.com. And what Jan does is record your voice for a couple of minutes, and based on what tones are stronger or weaker, those actually connect to various aspects of your health. And by working with those tones, you can actually use music and sound to help improve your health. What I do with voice mapping is something different, more on the emotional range, that the combinations of frequencies in your voice connect to emotional history, depending on what you're thinking about when you're doing that recording. And the magical part is when those frequencies are fed back to you in a biofeedback process, it helps unlock the place of buried memory, stress, and trauma. And you can release. And I have amazing stories about how this has helped people. And my website's very simple, mattkramer.com. And if you made it to this website for this show, then you see how it's spelled. And click on the banner for voice mapping. And feel free to contact me if you have questions. All right, commercial's over. It's a musical summer coming up. I know folks listen from all around the world. We're broadcasting from a little place in Northern California called Cotati. And actually, in about a month, we're going to have the Cotati Jazz Festival, and we're going to have a little stage right in front of my store, Ordinary Miracles. Also, first week in June, first weekend, is the Harmony Festival. And Damian Marley is going to be performing, and Angelique Kidjo, and George Clinton, and a whole lot of other folks, so lots of musical stuff happening here. And we have a wonderful musical guest tonight, Steve Seskin, who I've known off and on for many years, and he's got some really great stories to tell. And so without further ado, Steve, if you're still listening, hello.
Hello.
And I was actually very surprised. No, I should have been so surprised, because I've thought of you along the veins of friends of mine like Harold Payne, who've been around for a long time, written great songs, but mostly are known in the industry as opposed to being known that well publicly. But you did a house concert up here recently, and I had flyers in my store, and people walked in who went, Steve Seska, and I'll be there. And I just, you're becoming a real well-known guy. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. But I guess it's not, I'm not so well known that it's like a problem for me, you know?
Right.
Like, so
fun. Well, let's kind of do maybe the generic opening. What would you like the world to know about you?
Well, I'm proud to say I've been making music for a living for almost 40 years in different incarnations, but all music. And you know, I've always used my music for healing. Probably a little different application than I was listening to your 2 minute commercial. and I've always, it's always occurred to me the notion of music being healing in terms of the sound of it. But also you could extend that definition to trying to use music as healing for the world and for people and based on the lyrical content of songs. You know, that's always been part of my mission, is to move people and to make them feel something and think about their lives rather than escapism, you know, rather than forget about their life. I sort of want to make you think about your life in a good way, you know.
Well,
I think it's healthy.
It takes an art to, I'll say for myself as a struggling occasional songwriter, to be able to write a song that actually touches somebody outside of yourself, that you have a voice that is heard in sort of a common way in connected. Does that
make
sense?
Well, I always say that when I tell my story, my goal is to hopefully open a door for a whole lot of other people so that it becomes their story. Even if the facts aren't the same, if you can reach past the facts to an emotional place, people can relate to your story even if there are certain things about it that didn't exactly happen to them, you know, and they plug in their own story. And I think that's the mark of a good song is when you transcend the specific nature of the actual thing that happened to the songwriter, you know, and somebody else relates to it. And because if you don't do that, then, you know, it's kind of limited.
Can you remember when you first kind of grasped that concept?
Well, you know, I think ever since I started writing songs, I've understood the power of, you know, being a songwriter and the responsibility of it. And I think long before, you know, even stepping back, before I ever wrote a song, I knew as a listener the power of a song. And I was always, you know, I came up with the 60s and 70s singer-songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And although I do love the Beatles, and I did like them more for musical reasons than lyric, I was most drawn to the whole crop of 60s, 70s singer-songwriters, you know, who, and the folkies, you know, so everything from Pete Seeger to Peter Paul and Mary to Joni Mitchell, Jackson Brown, Crosby, Stills and Nash, James Taylor, that whole, Paul Simon especially, you know, where I was listening to music that spoke to me, you know, and certainly the music was super important. But usually for me it was a lyric, there had to be a lyric content that made me feel better or made me deal with something or, you know, it spoke to me. And so as a writer, I've always tried to emulate my favorite people in terms of being able to try and do that.
How old were you when you first wrote a song that you felt good about?
Oh, that I felt good about. You've added that equation here. Probably, well, let me think, 21 or 2.
That's not bad.
Yeah, which was about 5 years after I started writing songs.
that's actually a good amount of time to, you know, to start something, let it start to mature.
Oh, absolutely. And the writing is an ongoing process, you know, that I really do feel like I haven't necessarily written my best song yet, whatever that means. So I still look forward to writing hundreds of more songs, you know, for the rest of my life. I can't imagine not doing it.
That keeps you humble. You know,
so.
Haven't written that one yet. Would you say Don't Laugh at Me is your most famous song?
In one sense, yes, because that song has been turned into a school program by Peter Paul and Mary, Peter Yarrow of Peter Paul and Mary. And so it's the only song I have. I've had other songs that I've been fortunate enough to have out on the radio with people far more famous than me singing them. But that song is sort of ensconced itself into society.
Well, why don't you tell the story about it?
Well, I wrote it with my friend Alan Chamblin in 1998, and it's a song for those of you out there in Radio Land who haven't heard it. It's called Don't Laugh at Me, and the chorus is simply, don't laugh at me, don't call me names, don't get your pleasure from my pain. In God's eyes, we're all the same. Someday we'll all have perfect wings. Don't laugh at me. And the rest of it is about different characters who people are making fun of or laughing. So it laughing at, and it's kind of an anti-bullying song or an anti, you know, putting down people. And a song about compassion and realizing that, you know, everybody has something. Nobody's perfect, you know, but the last thing somebody needs is to have somebody else put them down for it, you know. And frankly, the application of it in schools was not on our minds when we wrote it. We just kind of wrote it, you know. But I will say that it was inspired by Alan's daughter coming home from school, being teased at school, you know. So it was Peter Yarrow of Peter Paul Mary who had the vision to turn the song into a character education curriculum for schools.
How did he hear it?
He heard it in Texas. I was at a folk festival called the Kerrville Folk Festival in Texas. And actually, a funny story, because I was teaching a class. I teach songwriting classes. And I was using Don't Laugh at Me as an example of using first person in a more universal way. So, for instance, there's a lot of characters in the song, but they all say, I'm a little boy with glasses, I'm the kid on every playground, I'm the beggar on the corner. So you're using first person, but obviously it's not in a literal sense where you're that person. And at the end of the class, a young woman came up to me and said, you know, my dad really needs to hear that song. And I said, well, it's on one of my CDs, you could get it, you know, and give it to him. And she said, well, my dad is Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary. And I said, well, I think he really does need to hear that song. You're correct. And so the next night, he happened to be coming into town, into the folk festival, because Peter, Paul, and Mary were playing that weekend. And he had Thursday night off, and she brought him to see my show. and he liked the song and brought it back to New York, and Paul and Mary heard it, and they started singing the song, which was, you know, a thrill for me, because if you think about most of the songs that Peter, Paul, and Mary have done, you know, there's a whole lot of good company you find yourself in.
Right.
And it was really about a year later when Columbine, unfortunately, happened.
Mm.
And that was the event that really, you know, got Peter thinking, we got to do something for schools. And, you know, there are a lot of character education curriculum for schools.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two things about the Don't Laugh at Me Operation Respect program that set it apart. And one, the main thing is it's free. So, and I'm not taking anything away from the people who write very good character education curriculums, but frankly, it's a business. They sell them to schools in general. And this program, we never wanted, that's not why we did it, you know. So we donated the song for the program, and all of the people that Peter enlisted to write the program and to facilitate getting it all distributed, everything about it was a donated effort. And the other thing that really sets it apart is it's very arts-based. So the whole notion of imparting messages to kids in schools of kindness and respect and diversity and peer pressure and self-esteem and on responsibility and all those good things, instead of just talking to them about it, this program really attempts to deliver the goods via song, art projects, theater skits. So it really gets them involved and gets them doing things. And so it was a twofold thing. It was Peter's notion that, and mine, that music and art and theater is a great way to reach kids. And also, if you can engage them in that, it's good in and of itself in a time where a lot of kids with no child left behind are being left behind, especially in terms of, you know, the arts in schools. So it's sort of like kill two birds with one stone, you know, get kids some arts education and then also give them some good messages about these things without them almost knowing that you're doing it, you know.
Well, I think it's been shown that the sort of traditional educational methods of rote memory only uses specific parts of a child's brain.
Right.
Whereas when you're incorporating, whether it's visual arts or the musical arts, that there's much more of the brain being engaged and cross-connecting. And,
absolutely.
And that's, I wish that was better known. I've had to face off conservative city council members on that one who want to cut arts funding.
Well, and I think most teachers know it. I mean, you know, most teachers that I speak to really believe that a lot of kids need the arts in terms of being able to, for self-esteem and for, you know, it's a way to reach certain kids that you're just not going to get to with regular methods.
Well, I'm looking on your website, which, by the way, folks, is steveseskin.com, Steve, S-E-S-K-I-N.com, and I see that you do some keynote speaking.
I do. Well, I mean, the other thing that's happened with this whole program is that, you know, back in 2000 is when the program started, and initially all I did was let them use the song. I was not involved that much, and then about 5-6 years ago, Peter asked me if I wanted to be more involved, and I said, what do you have in mind? And he said, well, I need somebody else other than me to go around and sort of spread the gospel of the program. And one of the ways we did that is to do teacher conferences and gatherings of principals and administrators and PTAs. And, you know, the education world has a conference every other 2 minutes,
right.
You know, somewhere in America. So anyway, over the last 6-7 years, I've done a lot of those kind of conferences and really do enjoy it. I mean, it's you know, educators are a really good audience in general, but especially for me, they're very literate and they're very, you know, they sort of appreciate messages and a lot of the kinds of songs that I write. And then the other thing I started doing was school visits.
Uh-huh.
A lot of assemblies and, that led me to do a songwriting program where now I'm going to schools and teaching kids how to write songs. So this whole thing, one little song, I mean, has led me to a lot of different, down a lot of different avenues that, frankly, I would have never guessed I'd be walking down, you know, 7-8 years ago.
Well, you must have some interesting stories then.
Oh, yeah. It's been amazing. You know, I mean, first of all, with kids, to really firsthand see the effect of music, you know, and to hear kids tell their stories about bullying and teasing and, you know, I mean, you know, I grew up, I'm 56, so in my era, you know, bullying was like, it's part of life, you know, girls will be girls, boys will be boys, you know, get used to it. Well, you know, I just don't think that works. I don't think it ever really worked, but nowadays it's really damaging to a lot of kids, and it manifests itself in far more serious ways. I mean, there have been almost 50 school shootings since Columbine.
Right.
You know, and they're not all attributable to bullying, but there's a really large correlation between those two issues. You know, and a lot of the kids who kind of crack and end up doing something like going in the cafeteria and shooting up the place, they're usually, when you do the research, they were, you know, ostracized or, bullied to a great extent, and they just couldn't take it anymore. Not to mention, by the way, the other kids who, like, teen suicides at an all-time high.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not all attributable to bullying, but there's a big correlation between, kids who just can't handle it anymore and end up taking themselves out so they don't have to deal with it. I mean, I'll give you one statistic that's chilling. 160,000 kids a day stay home from school in America who are not sick.
You're talking about truancy.
Well, truancy, and that figure is connected to because they're scared to go to school.
Okay.
So actually, at least where I got the figures from, there's some sort of notion that, again, I don't know how scientifically they prove this, because it's a good point that it could just be truancy, but, you know, where I read it and where I was told it from said that 160,000 kids are staying home because they're scared to go to school or because they don't want to deal with, you know, what they're having to deal with at school. So, you know, it's a big problem. I always say that I wish that the song was not, that kids didn't relate to it, you know, that it wasn't needed.
Right.
But I find that from kindergarten on up, kids relate to that song, and the main reason is because they do, because they've already experienced the hurt of somebody putting them down, you know. And so, I mean, what the program's trying to do is start kids early,
right.
You know. And it's not, you know, by the way, it's just so you know, it's a two-pronged program, you know, meaning that, or more like three. It's not just dealing with trying to give kids some tools to deal with being bullied, because it's not like we think it's never going to happen, you know. But also the idea of educating them on why it's not a cool thing to do. But then also the third one is also to deal with the bully, you know, because I don't think we're just going to send people who are doing bullying to an island somewhere. You know, in other words, we have to figure out, and schools are trying to figure out, why are these kids doing this? And usually you find out that it has something to do with their home life or their situation.
Well, there's an aspect here of sort of a general point of view, oh, well, kids will be kids, and or my kid has to learn to tough it out, and that sort of accepts it as almost a normal thing. And the bottom line is it's not normal. The kid who is the bully is dealing with pain that they either are or not aware of.
Right.
And I think to create some kind of a standard that one, you know, identifies the transgressors and provides tools for the victims is critically important.
I believe that also. And the other thing is there is a third group, by the way, which is by far the largest group,
uh-huh.
A friend of mine wrote a book called The Bully, The Bullied, and The Bystander.
Right.
And the bystander is like 90%. I mean, so if you have a school with like 800 kids, you have less than 5% of the kids are usually causing these problems we're talking about. And then you have 5% who are the victims, the targets, you know. And then you have 700 kids left over who are basically trying not to become the next victim, but they're also not doing they're not the aggressors either. But one of the goals of the program is, and of the song is to, get those kids to stand up for what they know is right. You know, recently I wrote a song with some sixth graders in a school called We Don't Do That Here.
Oh, great.
And it's the kids saying, hey, not at my school. We don't do that here. That's not cool. You know, and if you can imagine 700 kids talking to the 40, you know, maybe not all at once, but, you know, where the general air is, hey, we don't do that here, that can really change the climate of that community.
You know, what just came up for me is something called the Milgram Experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of it.
I haven't.
The Milgram Experiment was, I believe, in the 60s, and it was to see, in terms of what was it that allowed the behavior in the Nazi concentration camps to happen. And so students were simply asked to come participate in an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And a student was told, you're actually a small part of the experiment. We're actually studying the person on the other side of the wall there. And your job is to turn this dial, which increases an electrical current, to that subject. And you're helping me because I have to take notes here, and so you simply do what I tell you, and that's all you got to do is turn the dial.
Wow.
And so the person, they don't know the person inside the wall is an actor who does get some kind of signal in terms of how loud they should scream. You know, as the person in the white lab coat says, okay, turn it up to 6. Okay, now turn it to 7. And a surprisingly large number of those students, I mean, they would look at the guy in the lab coat and say, it sounds like he's really hurting over there. And it's like, well, that's okay. He signed up for the experiment, and you just keep doing it. And most of them just kept doing it.
Yeah.
You know, very few went and said, this is wrong, and I'm out of here. So the issue of what seems to be normalized by a figure of authority or that fearful authority of your peer pressure.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
And
you know, it reminds me also of, I can't remember who it was that said this, but if you've ever been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., there's that thing where it says, you know, they came for the, you know, for this group, and I didn't speak up.
Right, the Catholics, the homosexuals.
Right, they, and you know, and then finally they came for me, and there was nobody
left to speak up for me.
To speak up for me, you know. So I think that's interesting. And one of the things I do when I go to schools is to talk to kids about standing up for what they know is right, you know, and saying something.
Well, now another challenge comes up, just thinking this goes back to songwriting, which is when I try to write a song about a message, the message overtakes the musicality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the real skill is to write a song that's enjoyable to listen to, and the message doesn't compromise that.
Well, and I think part of that has to do with how you house it musically, but I also do think that it has to do with how, when you write a song that's, quote, a message song, you have to be careful that you house it in a way that doesn't come off, I don't know if you've heard this word, preachy.
Yeah.
But it's like, I have no right to tell people how to live or, you know, that make it sound like I know better than them. Even if I think I do, it doesn't matter, you know. And so I always try to find a way to house a song in terms of the point of view where the listener can really, you know, take in what I'm saying. A good example would be at the beginning of, just not to totally change the subject here, but you guys played Two Paper Town at the beginning of the show. And that's a song where I had to be really careful because, you know, if you can imagine what that's about, you know, it's I wanted to be careful, what, as I am with every song, what is my goal? What is this song really about? You know, so Two Paper Town, you know, could be about, I could have made it sort of a liberal rant, you know, because that's where my politics come from, you know.
Right.
But it really wasn't my point. My point was, you know, when I was driving around in the Midwest and some other places in America, I noticed that there were a lot of communities that had one paper and one radio station and one TV station. And a lot of times they were owned by, I won't mention, but the same company. And a lot of times they were fairly conservative in their bent, you know. And so that happened to be the case. But that's not what I wanted to focus on, you know, meaning that I really wanted the song to be about having access to all sides of a story. You know, living in a two-paper town and making up our own minds about things rather than being led like sheep.
Yeah, I'm reading a book now that sort of exposes O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Unspinning the Spin.
Unspinning the Spin. Very interesting.
You know, where, you know, because Fox says that they're fair and balanced, and O'Reilly says that he, you know, he uncovers the spin, and this is the no-spin zone.
Yeah, right.
Right. So, ironically, it's a no-spin zone from a very conservative point of view. It was interesting to read. He gets really angry if you call him a conservative. He claims he's not.
Right.
Which simply says, what I see as the center of the road may look right to you, to the far right, but that's because you're way too far left.
Sure.
Something along those lines.
But I mean, like, in that song, there's a line that says, it doesn't really matter which side you're on. Nobody wins when our choices are gone. Both sides of a story, you know, often lead to the truth. Well, you know, in one sense, there's an untruth there. When I say it doesn't really matter which side you're on, well, I definitely have a side of the coin that I'm on, you know. But again, it wasn't the point of the song. And I, when I tend to write those kind of songs, I don't want to write a rant. And I can appreciate a good rant as a listener.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, a rant is when you're totally preaching to the choir.
Right.
And that's fine. But I prefer to have the guy who I really want to reach, who maybe doesn't agree with me, I'd like to not alienate him or her and let them listen to the whole song. So my goal is more like, hey, that's interesting. I never thought of it like that, you know?
Well, yeah, what you're saying is give them the opportunity to think for themselves.
Exactly.
And if you're ranting, you're maybe presuming they're not thinking appropriately for themselves.
Right, and I'm going to alienate them, and they won't even hear what I really have to say.
Right.
You know, and really, one of the ways politically that I use my music is to bring people together. At least that's my goal. You know, because frankly, I'm not a big fan of radio. It's funny, I love talk radio, but I don't love, you know, whether it be, you know, Air America or Rush Limbaugh, you know. I really don't care to listen to people just putting down the other side.
Right.
Because I think we've got that's led us to an incredibly polarized place, which doesn't really serve us very well. And I don't sit here, by the way, saying I have the answer of how to bring us all together, but the notion that we need to come more together, you know, I think is a good one.
Do you have any stories of people say that something significant changed for them as a result of your music?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I can think of a lot of songs where I've certainly gotten at least a little bit of feedback from a person or two or three of the effect it's had on them. And Don't Laugh at Me has been one of those songs. I've gotten hundreds of emails from people who said the song was healing for them. You know, one of the interesting things with that song is if you go to YouTube, If you're ever having a boring day,
I love YouTube.
Go to YouTube and type in Don't Laugh at Me, and you'll find, not only will you find the Peter, Paul, and Mary video and Mark Wills, the country guy, but you'll find 60 other videos that people have done, from little kids singing it to teenagers to teachers with their classes. And then you'll find some of them where kids are, like, interviewed after singing the song and talk about what the song means to them. And I mean, that just blows my mind, you know. So that's been really amazing. I have another song called Grown Men Don't Cry that I've gotten a lot of emails about and feedback, without going into the whole song. It's the hook of it is, I don't know why they say grown men don't cry, because in this course of this song, this grown man is crying several times.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of that song is to give men the, you know, the, to let them feel like they have the right to cry,
right.
You know, because so here again, I'm trying to knock down that stereotypical societal myth that men are supposed to, like, be a man, suck it up, you know, and that we're not supposed to get all emotional about something, you know, when in fact that's a ridiculous notion.
Well, on one hand, one way to look at it would be is, you don't know what you're missing.
Well, yeah, we could go even further with it, but also you could start out by saying it's incredibly unhealthy to bottle up all your emotions. You can't not have them, you know, the feelings about different things that happen in your life. So if you're expending a whole lot of energy to not let it show, I figure that's energy you could be putting into dealing with it and fully experiencing grief, if that's what in fact you're going through,
as opposed to taking it out on your kids.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And whoever else.
Yeah, it manifests itself in a lot of not so great ways, you know, men keeping their emotions bottled up. So here again, you know, that I've gotten a lot of feedback about that song. And speaking of taking it out on your kids, I mean, I've also had a song. I have a song called "I Think About You" that a guy named Colin Ray recorded. That is about a father who is looking at society from the eyes of a father of an 8-year-old daughter, and you know, being kind of fearful for the world he's sending her out into, and specifically in terms of her sexuality coming up in the next 10 years. You know, he's looking at how the world uses sexuality to sell us everything, and you know, whatever it may be, however it manifests itself. But he's just worried about his little girl,
right?
Type of deal, and the big bad world he's sending her out into. And here again, I've gotten a lot of feedback from people, either battered women, people in shelters, you know, that have heard it. But a couple of times, the more poignant times have been when it's reached some men who really needed to hear that song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and here again, when I start out writing songs like that, I'm not like sitting there going, I need to reach these men. You know, I'm just like talking about what's on my heart, you know. And that's the other thing about songs, is that you never know how somebody is going to take something that you write and how it's going to reach somebody. Because somebody once said this to me, and I don't know who to quote here, but that when you finish a creation, whether it be a painting or a poem or a book or a song, you finish it in that you declare it as done, and then you put it out into the world, but that you don't really finish it. The listener and the viewer finishes it.
You know, that's kind of a Vygotskian, if you've heard of Lev Vygotsky.
Ah, okay.
Oh, no, I take it back. I'm showing off here. The philosopher, Oxford philosopher. Anyway, what he said was, you know, is a thought complete when you think it? Wittgenstein.
Ah,
or is it truly complete when it leaves your lips? That it's the act of speaking it that actually is what completes the thought.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and you could look at it like the two of us could stand at a painting, and it's going to speak to us in different ways, and it has everything to do with what our life experience is.
I have a don't know if you know, I'm a professional mediator, and sometimes when I'm doing training, one of the things I teach people is a tool I call broadcast versus reception. That I say something to you, and I know based on how I was raised, my cultural influences, you know, exactly what I mean by the words that come out of my mouth.
Sure.
But I have no idea what you received. And it's often completely different.
Well, you know, and what's interesting about that, that exact concept, when I teach songwriting, that whole thing comes into play every time I say anything in a song. Because as the songwriter, I choose language that I hope will get across a certain point that I think I'm making quite nicely and succinctly, thank you. But you find out over and over again that, oh, those words didn't mean that to that person. And then, you know, in one sense, when you, if I write something and I could theoretically do a scientific test where I would line up 100 people and 97 of them get the meaning that I wanted them to get, well, I've done my job. In other words, I can't account for the other three people who had different upbringings or whatever, and their reception is just, they're not going to get it. However, there are times when my broadcasting thing, you know, I'm playing it for 100 people and 23 people are getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells me that the other 77, you know, like maybe I could be clearer is what I'm trying to say.
Well, also, there might be something for you to learn from those 77.
Exactly.
And, if I wanted to go back, when you talked about the father thinking about his little daughters being influenced by the media and by commercialism and materialism, et cetera, I'm reminded of a story, I think over 10 years ago I read this, where it's a little black girl, like 4 or 5 years old, and was just learning how to read. And she's in the supermarket with her mom, and what she's suddenly realizing is she sees angel food cake, and it's white.
Oh, right.
And then she sees devil's food cake, and it's black.
Wow.
And that was just really earth-shattering to the mom to kind of, you know, how does she protect her daughter in that context?
Sure.
So
that's interesting.
Sometimes I say we're kind of an embarrassing species.
Yeah, we have our moments, don't we?
Yeah. Can you describe things your audiences have taught you?
Well, you know, one thing my audiences have taught me is that they really appreciate honesty and truth. And one thing that I really try to tell myself and impress upon my songwriting students is that nobody's impressed with, and when I say nobody, the listening public is unimpressed by your use of the language or, you know, what I call writerish phrases.
Clever.
Like where it sounds like the writer walked in the room.
Uh-huh.
If you don't reach them on some other level. You know, I'm not saying that somebody can't appreciate good use of the language and colorful writing, but, you know, when something transcends, you know, that to become just clever and just like a written line, or nobody would ever say that, you know, and you're in the middle of a song that's sort of a conversation where people are talking. I think, you know, you get a little more leeway if you house it in a certain genre that allows for it. You know, so for instance, if you're writing a funny, sort of clever play on word song, then you get to go over the top more, you know. But my audience has taught me that they really appreciate just truth.
Right.
And being touched, you know. And again, I'm a singer-songwriter, so I'm, you know, as you know, you've seen me perform, I'm coming at you with me and a guitar. So, I don't, musically, I don't have like the big band or the, you know, I'm not saying that people can't appreciate my music for, in and of itself, but really I'm a wordsmith.
My fear would be is how does the band not get in the way of that?
Yeah. you know, and I've never really performed much with a band, you know, so I don't have a lot of experience doing that. But I'll tell you one thing, when I go to hear somebody that I really like, and they've got a big band, that band better be tasteful
mm-hmm.
and realize that they are supporting a wordsmith. Because I hate when I go sometimes and the band's like trying to like show their chops and, you know, play over this, you know, or when the mix is so that the singer can barely be heard. And it's somebody who's a lyric driven, you know.
I think you were at my place maybe a couple times,
mm-hmm.
the club I used to have in L.A.
Yeah.
And this is before I learned how to be a mediator, but I often saw that battle between the singer who hired some backup guys but couldn't really pay them a lot of money.
Yeah.
So they made up for it on their own on stage, and there were some devastated egos often, you know, the guitar player that won't turn down. And,
yeah.
That kind of thing.
Well, there have been times when I've, you know, where I go to a concert and somebody who has a band gets rid of the band, like for a few songs.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, oh, great. You know, and that's not, you know, I mean, I love music with that's fully produced, you know, with a big band when it's done tastefully, you know. But I also like, I think there's something to be said for simple presentation.
I think one example for me is Taj Mahal.
Oh, great example.
I mean, I've always enjoyed him most when I've seen him solo.
Me too.
And he's been, I have to give him credit for taking lots of experiments with lots of different kinds of bands.
Right.
But he becomes about 20% of the show.
Oh, yeah, and I, you know, I've opened for Taj Mahal over the years, I don't know, 30 or 40 times, you know, and here again, give me that guy just sitting on a chair playing by himself. There's nothing quite as magical as that.
Tell us a bit about Kerrville Folk Festival, because a lot of folks don't know about it, and I'm afraid to go, because I think once I go, I'm never going to want to leave.
Well, the Kerrville Folk Festival, maybe I can lump it in with some others, the Rocky Mountain Folk Festival in Colorado, and the Kerrville Folk Festival, there's many in Canada. You know, all of those festivals celebrate music that is more acoustic in nature than anything. And the biggest thing about the Kerrville Folk Festival is it's an 18-day festival that really celebrates the songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
It has a songwriting contest called New Folk that give new people opportunities to showcase their wares. And it has 18 days of stages, you know. I mean, there's a lot of people play there. And a lot of really good people. And some of them have bands. But, I mean, the focus is on a really great song. You don't hear a lot of people talking about, oh, you should hear this band. God, the horn player was fabulous. It's more like, did you hear that song about the, you know. And so the buzz that you hear is usually about a song.
Right.
And people learning each other's songs. And the other thing that happens at those festivals, if anybody's ever you know, fortunate enough to go, is over. You can just attend the festival and come for the concert and go hear the music and then go home. Or you can camp there and stay there, or even stay at the hotel if you're not a camper. But point being that when the show's over every night, there are campfires all over this ranch, like probably, I don't want to exaggerate, but at least 50 different gatherings of people that have anywhere from 3 to 10, 15 people sitting around playing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is two things. One, that gives the casual listener, but who also is a player, the opportunity to sing and play, you know, with some other people. And what you have is, you know, I'll start playing a song, and all of a sudden out of the night comes a fiddle player or a mandolin player or another guitar player, you know, sitting in.
Well, when musicians are playing for musicians, to me that's when it's really magical.
Oh, it's just been great, you know, to do that. And the same thing happens at Rocky Mountain Folk Festival in Colorado. And I just I really look forward to those gatherings, because I do two or three of them every year. And you know, the other thing is they build community. So you know, you see the same people and some new people, and but it becomes like a big mecca, you know, for like-minded people in a creative sense, which is really nice, you know, in an age where there's not nearly enough of that.
Well, it's, I think, fascinating, because I think between, say, folk festivals and house concerts and small clubs, coffee houses, there is kind of a quiet community that is not acknowledged in mainstream media, is not acknowledged in the commercial corporate music world, but it's the place where I think the music is the most vibrant.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, house concerts are another whole phenomenon that have sprung up, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, but big time in the last 5 years. And they're like people taking matters into their own hands and having people play in their homes. It's the coffee house of the 60s is now in people's homes.
And for those of you folks listening, if you can see 10, 20, or 30 people in your living room, you can have a house concert, and there are musicians that would love to play there.
And you'd be amazed at the quality of the musicians that would love to play there.
You know Chuck Pyle?
Sure, I know Chuck very well.
And I've seen Chuck get a standing ovation from 2,000 people first time I saw him, and he's signing albums afterwards. I said, "You wouldn't do a house concert, would you?" And he goes, "Maybe." And he's done two of them for me.
Sure.
You know, just and so actually, I'd like, I don't know if you can quantify it at all, because I feel that while concert tickets are up in the $100 range and scalping even higher, you know, your average house concert is between $10 and $20 a ticket and a much better environment.
Well, and the other thing that happens just from an economic sense is that, you know, you're not going to have five-piece bands too often playing house concerts.
Not too often.
Both for the sound situation and all that. But for a solo artist, you know, who's on the road or something, who goes to an area, for instance, where they're not that well known, to be able to come to somebody's house. I've done them at my home, you know, where I get about 40, 45 people, and usually it's a $15 donation you're asking for, and all that money goes to the artist. You know, maybe the person has some desserts or something and takes out a few bucks for that, but basically that artist would have to draw 125 people to earn the same amount of money at a club. And it's not that the club is the big bad club owner. They've got insurance. They've got, you know, they've got to make some money. Whereas the person who's doing a house concert is doing it for the love of the music. But I think the biggest thing also about house concerts is that it really does breed community. You were at the one I did in Petaluma the other night. And, you know, one, I ran into people I hadn't seen in 20 years who'd heard of me, you know, way back when. I've since organized doing another one in Petaluma at somebody's backyard who was there, you know, brought a few friends. But also the people there were talking to each other, you know, and so the people from the community all of a sudden talk to each other at a house concert in a way that they probably wouldn't do if they were sitting in Petaluma at the... What's that place? The theater? Mystic? No, not Mystic. What's it called?
Yeah, the Mystic Theater.
The Mystic Theater. No, this is not a knock on the Mystic Theater, by the way. Wonderful place. Does great shows. But people don't talk to each other in the intermission.
You don't talk to strangers in the dark.
Exactly. Whereas a house concert, a lot of people go, "Hey, don't you? Yeah, I run the bookstore." And all of a sudden, you know, there's more to it than just the music. The music becomes a catalyst for bringing people together, you know.
Yeah.
And I think we need that more than ever in our world. So,
exactly.
Happy to be part of it, you know.
I'm kind of going through a bit of culture shock because, you know, I ran clubs in L.A. I produced concerts in L.A. I know what it takes to do that. And for the last 5 years, I've lived in this little co-housing community, and it's just so easy. So there's a band called the Biscuit Burners. I don't know if you've heard of them.
I know the name. I don't know them.
They're a very progressive bluegrass band. A couple of the members went to India and brought back a sitar. So you got a little bit of bluegrass with sitar happening and things like that. And last time they played, they pulled 90 people, way too big for my space. So I'm trying to say, okay, if I step outside my comfort zone and I'm talking to a little veterans hall that's here, and there's another hall next to City Hall in Cotati. Right, so I got to come up with $500 deposit. I got to come up with insurance.
Sure. there you go.
And another band says, well, we think we should get a guarantee. You know, and at one point, the agent made me a percentage offer. I realized, I said, you know, your offer is I put up $1,200, and if I sell 100 tickets, I'll make $70.
And all of a sudden, you don't really feel like doing it, even though you like the music.
I remember now why I left the music business.
Right.
Et cetera. I don't know if Seth is listening. It's got, we're coming to the end of our hour here. And Seth, you able to pull another song off the website there?
The almighty dollar. I thought it would fill this hole in me and I'd be satisfied. I was a thirsty man dying for water, drinking from a well that always left me dry. I'm looking for something I can really sink my teeth into. Something that shakes my soul and makes me really feel. Yeah, what I'm looking for. All I want anymore is something.
And that was a taste of Steve Seskin's music. I encourage you to go to his website, steveseskin.com, and if you can see him, whether it's a house concert or a commercial concert, Steve, I've always enjoyed any place I've seen you perform.
Well, thanks, man.
And I'm very honored that you were on our show tonight, and hope we'll get you back in a while.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk with you and to talk to, you know, be able to talk a little bit about what I do and why. And I also find it very interesting what you're doing with sound and healing. And so to all you people out there in Radio Land, thanks. It's been nice being on the air here for a while.
All right. Have a good evening, and we'll see you all next week.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye, Steve.
Another 12-hour day, working as a seamstress in Montgomery. She climbed aboard a bus. There was nobody sitting there when she took that seat. Said, I'm not getting up. Ordinary act of courage that sparked a revolution. She wasn't trying to be a problem, just part of a solution. She was one drop of water in an ocean of hope. One voice of reason who finally spoke. Said if we're ever gonna get along, if peace is our desire,